Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Labor Day weekend is just offshore, and I would like to commemorate its true purpose. I should beforehand give a disclaimer that what I am going to say is my opinion, and perhaps mine only, in all the surrounding cosmos of and including this paltry planet. I call it Labor Lost. And I begin with a quote from the Industrial Workers of the World, the IWW. Labor creates all wealth. To labor, all wealth rightfully belongs. Labor Day means little more than a final three-day holiday that ends the silly season, bookended with Memorial Day, which starts it. Neither holiday means much anymore, although the first one will probably be gussied up to absolve and perpetuate the continual harvests of war dead. Labor Day once celebrated working people, but now that is a joke. Unions don't march on Labor Day anymore because workers who produce the GNP are consistently undervalued, which originally forced them to unionize. You might not know it, but Oregon was the first state to make Labor Day a holiday on February 21st, 1887. 5 years later, Labor Day became a national holiday in honor of strikers killed by police and military during the brutal and bloody Pullman strike of 1894. The American labor movement seems to be coming undone, not quite near death, but grievously battered. The country is in a period of severe decline of the personal and political rights of people who work for a living, which makes it imperative working people understand what is at stake on the job and in the democracy at large. And remember that Abraham Lincoln said, labor is superior to capital and, quote, deserves much the higher consideration. The power of American labor unions as a force to represent and protect the rights and persons, as well as jobs, in American industry has faded over the past decades. This erosion of social and political equity of people who produce the gross national products of America is due in part to an increasingly global capitalist economy since the end of the Cold War, and to increasingly fierce and exceptionally greedy international competition between corporate empires. Union influence is vulnerable to diversified pan-corporatism, especially in highly automated industries, and virtually powerless to halt overseas relocations. Union busting has decimated many of the country's largest and formerly strongest unions. Labor law has failed to protect workers, and government acts as a tool for the company. Corporations breach labor laws and are not held accountable. Union strikers are arrested and heavily fined. The bitter assault by government and industry has crippled union power to such an extent that unions are unable to gain significant wage raises or protect the jobs of hundreds of thousands who are sacrifices to company mismanagement, downsizing, or divestiture as a result of incessant corporate Wall Street-inspired takeovers and mergers. The American labor movement succumbed to its own success and the long-savored revenge of the bosses it temporarily trumped. The power labor gained was immense. It was bitterly won and carelessly lost. When the Reagan administration chose to attack unions in the early 1980s by breaking a strike by aircraft controllers and forever banning the strikers from government work, it was aware the labor movement was weak and unable to resist a savage campaign of union busting. Unions were by then little more than huge bureaucracies that had lost contact with their rank and file. Their leaders were raised to social levels with salaries plus perks, nearly equal to corporate executives. Dissent was usually squelched within the locals, while union and corporate officials colluded on the same class levels. For members of most unions, mandatory dues were and remain a tax on their wages at the same time they were denied meaningful or coherent representation. The corporate class bitterly resented the labor movement's power and exacted savage revenge throughout the Reagan Bush senior years, attacking unions in their shops like wolves circling downed beasts. The older industrial unions were ripped apart. Hundreds of thousands of workers were forced to take huge pay cuts and the loss of medical insurance benefits to keep their jobs in industries that were financially crippled, dismantled, or sold off. Many thousands more lost their jobs when workplaces closed or relocated to the third world. Communities that depended on smokestack or sold off industries paid huge ransoms of public money to keep them operating or to attract newer ones. Top echelons of corporate raiders dismantled their subsidiaries to protect their headquarters bastions from corporate raiders, in the meantime feeding on each other in frenzies of takeovers. Their unions gutted and powerless to protect them, American workers were pawns and generally losers in the bloody corporate wars, disinherited at the same time American corporations employed low-wage foreign labor to make their products at cheaper cost. The new realities of world commerce aggregate the problems affecting American labor. American corporations subsidize cheap labor and manufacturing costs in destitute nations by ordering finished products from them instead of producing domestically, which adds not only to imbalance of trade, but shrinks the number of jobs for American workers. The United States converts from a producer nation to a global corporate headquarters complex, in which computer programmers and accounts clerks are more important than steel workers or farmers. The nation is more interested in consuming than producing. Real work shifts overseas where the only competition is in degrading wages and increasing production, especially among young women, reminiscent of U.S. sweatshops in the early 20th century and more recently in the Pacific Southwest. The boomerang consequence is that the race to the bottom in wages overseas competitively shrivels domestic incomes in the USA. As the American workforce shrinks, the power of the already weakened unions is further eroded. Workers in need of work accept low-paying and non-union jobs and lose their rights and protection. In addition, eliminating entire categories of workers from employment necessitates huge public welfare costs, which the financial and corporate barons who eliminated the jobs are not paying, leaving it to the already overburdened working classes to pay. Trotsky was right when he said that labor must be universal rather than nationalized, because corporate industry is global. Jobs are cut in the USA and exported offshore to poverty-plagued countries with non-existent or harassed labor movements. Violations of international workers' rights are used for competitive advantage by U.S. corporations that are searching the world for impoverished countries with low-wage workers, even employing prison and slave labor while engaging in destroying indigenous labor movements and imprisoning or murdering local labor leaders. Unions once were, in the words of Kurt Vonnegut, admirable instruments for extorting something like justice from employers. But labor is badly wounded, and its history is treated like pornography. Strikes are crippled with injunctions, and workers are denied government aid while on strike. No tax breaks either. Union busting has frightened union leaders into painful compromises, and binding agreements are torn up by management. The legal framework of the labor movement needs radical change. Political solutions in which workers' rights and union democracy in its broadest sense are guaranteed are necessary. A generous concept of labor democracy would give workers more rights, both in collective bargaining and law, and would allow them a voice in investment policy and in such matters as layoffs, plant shutdowns, takeovers, and in selection of top management. The tax code should be revised to credit companies that avoid layoffs in profitable times and give employees a stake in company policy, as well as good medical coverage and broad retraining opportunities. Workers' rights should be manifested in various ways that would prohibit employer interference in their decisions about organizational representation, which should include unions with only a minority of workers and mandate collective bargaining that leads to solid contracts. Radical changes in labor law must obviously be accompanied with wide involvement of women, blacks, Asians, Hispanics, and Native Americans, plus physically handicapped and mentally retarded workers, and should focus on a social crusade framed as an extension of American democracy instead of pressure group whining. A special effort should be made to recreate a social justice movement like civil rights in the 1960s. Such a sharply defined crusade would be an initial stage in educating and mobilizing union members. The next objective would be for these members to spread labor's gospel as far as possible in schools, churches, civic meetings, political caucuses. To bring strong political support into the labor movement, more workers need to be organized and be willing to risk and endure long-standing picket lines like Astoria's mechanics, who lost several years ago in Astoria. Rebirth of a robust labor movement requires enfranchising women and minorities, the rise of vigorous new leaders untainted by corruption, reversing the decline and increased costs of education, and most importantly, unified action and collective bargaining to halt labor's collapse in post-industrial America. Re-establishment of a union culture in the United States and radical reforms of union laws must be a primary goal, for the good reason that labor and production are at the heart of economic health and survival. Harry Johnson of Astoria posed a trenchant question in an article he wrote for the North Coast Times-Eagle a few years ago. We need a labor movement. He asked, what if the Oregon AFL-CIO sent a team of organizers into Clatsop County to organize every unorganized shop, business, farm, temp agency, fish plant, or government program? His answer was that local workers would have the chance to sign up for whatever unions fit their jobs and, quote, still have a big local of workers who wouldn't have a union to attach to, which would be kind of an all-other community union. Eventually, these community union locals could hook up into a statewide union that could affiliate with the Service Employees International Union, probably the most progressive union in the country. Harry wrote, think of the power of having 50% of the workers in an area, in a state, organized. How about 80%? The strength of a union versus individuals in dealing with and making demands for a fair shake from companies is, or should be, fairly obvious. The strength of organized labor versus independent unions in dealing with international corporations and the government should be even more obvious. Harry suggested that political candidates would need endorsements by reorganized labor and, quote, would have to work on our issues instead of a corporate agenda. Harry surmised that this union-friendly impact on the state legislature would pressure it to pass pro-labor legislation. For instance, he wrote, Oregon could pass a law similar to several Canadian provinces, which would allow for union certification if a majority of workers signed cards without having to wait for an election, thus reducing considerably the time for employers to intimidate, threaten, or fire union supporters. Oregon could also pass a law ordering binding arbitration for initial contracts to speed the process. Harry wrote that a strong labor movement is the only answer to prevent the collapse of American workers' wages to third world levels and would counterbalance the power of greedy multinational corporations. And that was Harry Johnson. President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who enacted a New Deal to confront the first Great Depression, caused primarily by Wall Street financial institutions and their international banking allies, sound familiar, proposed a second Bill of Rights. Every American has the right to, one, a job, two, an adequate wage and decent living, three, a decent home, four, medical care, five, economic protection during sickness, accident, old age, or unemployment, six, a good education. Roosevelt said, "The test of our progress is not whether we add more to the abundance of those who have much. It is whether we provide enough to those who have too little." Roosevelt also said, "If I went to work in a factory, the first thing I'd do is join a union." It was during the Depression that American labor was able to use sit-down strikes and fight pitched battles with police, hired goons, and scabs to successfully confront steel, auto, rubber, and other smokestack industries, and as well conduct two major maritime strikes on the West Coast that involved Astoria and every other port city. Unions reached their peak those years with vast organizing drives that gave birth to the CIO and set examples of militant solidarity that proved beneficial to other unions in the great labor struggles of the 1930s and for many years afterward. As the pundit said, unions are bad, but without them, it's worse. That perception is all too apparent when millions of workers lose their jobs, the discrepancy in wages and benefits between management and labor is obscene, and the people who have jobs are required to produce more for less pay with little or no labor rights or job security. The first permanent national organization in the United States, the International Typographical Union, acknowledged at its first convention in 1850, quote, "It is useless for us to disguise from ourselves the fact that, under the present arrangement of things, there exists a perpetual antagonism between labor and capital, one side striving to sell their labor for as much and the other striving to buy it for as little as they can." I was president for 3 years of a small company union that was affiliated with a much larger parent union. I represented a membership generally inactive and unhappy they must pay union dues on salaries barely above minimum wage, which the union was not very successful raising. And, of course, the company actively attempted to smash the union. I wrote a letter to the wage slaves I represented. Some of you believe the union is just another bureaucracy that takes money out of your paychecks. Most of you rarely attend union meetings or participate in decisions that affect you, yet the union is your opportunity to have a voice and a measure of power over your working lives, the more so the more you participate. Perhaps you are vague about or do not particularly respond to what our ancestors considered necessary fundamentals for maintaining personal and political liberty, but erosions of them will eventually ruin your lives. Democracy is always in flux between those who wish to protect and enlarge it and those who reduce and constrict it. We are in a period of severe decline of the personal and political rights of people who work for a living, which makes it imperative we understand what is at stake on the job and in the democracy at large. It is of great importance that you take the power the union offers you to determine your working future." And that is something I wrote, Labor's Labor Loss, and it's particularly aimed at Labor Day weekend, which is just a party anymore, has nothing to do with what its purposes were originally. Well, I'd like to read another piece I wrote, so my disclaimer still holds. I call it Mighty Moe's Last Voyage. pretty close to everybody in the world probably knows that World War II officially ended 70 years ago yesterday, September 2nd, 1945, with the signing of surrender documents by representatives of what immediately afterward became the former Empire of Japan. The American Army General Douglas MacArthur presided over the occasion on board the American battleship USS Missouri. He imperiously announced after the formal surrender, "These proceedings are closed," as if the horrible war just ended was equivalent to a corporate stockholders meeting. The Mighty Mo was not the most veteran American warship when President Harry Truman designated it as the site upon which defeated Japan would surrender. It might have been more fitting if one of the resurrected battleships sunk at Pearl Harbor had accepted the surrender. But Truman was from the state of Missouri, and USS Missouri became America's most famous battleship, save one, Arizona, which is enshrined in the mud at Pearl Harbor, with most of its crew entombed with it. Missouri stayed in service through the Korean War, leapfrogged Vietnam, though its sister, New Jersey, was recommissioned for that war, and served with another sister of the Iowa class, Wisconsin, in the Persian Gulf War. Though Missouri fought off Japanese kamikazes, struck glancingly by one, and shelled enemy shores in three wars, it never engaged in the battleship battle, which had been designed for in the late 1930s. But it might have at Lady Gulf alongside resurrected Pearl Harbor veterans that got their revenge on the Japanese fleet. Yet historical what-ifs are like video games, in that they present fascinating possibilities while killing time. Missouri, like her sisters, was left to rot following her final service until in the spring of 1998 the U.S. Navy was put upon to make a decision whether to scrap or preserve. The pressure from preservationists prevailed, which is why the old battleship spent its few last days in the continental USA in Astoria, Oregon, under tow from mothballs in Bremerton, Washington, by an appropriately named ocean-going towboat, Sea Victory, to Hawaii, where it would be moored near Arizona on Pearl Harbor's battleship Roe, quite fittingly as the first and last memorials to the Pacific War. Missouri became a part of Astoria's history as a result of the need to kill saltwater organisms clogging her bottom in the Columbia River's fresh water, and to not export Northwest sea life to the islands. An estimated 150,000 people crowded into Astoria for a last look at a vital relic of the nation's history before it took up station at its Pacific Gateway as a floating museum next to the sunken ruin of the only other American battleship as famous. More than 57,000 went aboard Missouri, approximately 1,000 an hour, the 5 days the ship was open to the public. The average wait in line to board was 3 to 4 hours each day, and once aboard, people had at least two more lines to view the plaque placed on the deck where the Allies and Japanese signed off World War II, and to exit the old ship. Almost everyone was patient, and most felt honored and awesome that they stood on the exact spot the worst war in history formally ended. Thousands more came to take a possibly final, and for most also a first, dockside look at Missouri without boarding, to see, as Herman Wouk described in his famous novel, The Kane Mutiny, quote, "the vast flat steel wall of the battleship's side that towered like a skyscraper and stretched away on either side seemingly for blocks. The great citadel of bridges and stacks that jutted out of the deck skyward, a pyramid of metal that during World War II was nervous in anti-aircraft batteries and radars, and the main battery, the long cannon, with turrets that seemed bigger than entire ships." Americans are notorious for being largely indifferent to their history. Yet sometimes a collective court of memory revives, and they respond as they did to Missouri's short visit to Astoria, a full century after the first battleships helped make the United States a world power. Missouri almost the world's last battleship, represented what might well be considered the nation's high water mark. Missouri left Astoria in the same manner it arrived, under tow, disappearing to a large, watchful crowd into fog that rolled up from the river's mouth late Wednesday afternoon, June 3, 1998. The old battleship towered over more recent Navy vessels visiting the city before going upriver to that year's Rose Festival in Portland. 8 years earlier, its sister battleship, New Jersey, had been a guest at the 1990 Rose Festival, but was delayed for a few hours by a group of Greenpeace members who rappelled off the Astoria Bridge to protest Navy policy of neither confirming or denying whether nuclear weapons were aboard any of its vessels, in this instance, in probable violation of Clatsop County's voter-mandated designation as a nuclear-free zone. The moment the mighty Mo moved toward the ocean under tow, another famous vessel, Astoria's own salvage chief, blasted its horn in tribute. Labor Day this year is also the date my close friend and badass mentor, Ronald L. Pierce, was shot and killed by a sniper in Vietnam on September 7th, 1966. 1 year less than half a century ago. He looked like Robert Mitchum and wore gloves like an old-time gunfighter when he took his rifle to work with him, which was nearly all day and night every day. The USMC was not unionized. R.L. was a good-humored cynic, which is probably why he had tattooed on his back a 12-inch face of Jesus Christ in thorns in three colors, red, blue, and green. After he was dead, a chaplain was shocked at the tattoo. He seemed to nearly levitate when I turned Pierce's body backside up. And he asked, why? He thought Jesus was a joke, I said. I regret I did not have the presence of mind or temerity to skin Pierce and preserve his tattoo of Christ in thorns. I think he might have expected me to. I wish I had saved it from maggots and framed it for my wall. I dedicate today's program to him and to Julia Rutila, who was a vital part of Northwest labor history for more than 60 years, since she was a child passing out IWW leaflets. She was a small, quietly spoken woman who served on countless picket lines and in as many defense committees for jailed union men and women. She was arrested often and was often the victim of labor violence. She wrote for the labor press for half a century. She died in her late 80s, actively protesting the first Persian Gulf War. And this has been Michael McCusker. Happy Labor Day.